gynecologist, and his work really focuses on improving access to and simplifying abortion and contraception in the U.S., Latin America, and the Caribbean, and sub-Saharan Africa.
Thanks. So I'm going to talk a little bit about provider perspective related to a possible OTC switch for oral contraceptives. First, I should say that I have no relationships to disclose. There really isn't any published data. There are no published surveys that have looked at what physicians or advanced practice clinicians think about providing over-the-counter access to oral contraceptives. There are a couple of opinion pieces that have recently been published, and that's what I'm going to base this on. One of them, I put some copies out on the chairs. It was something that was published in Contemporary OBGYN, where I wrote the side of the debate in favor of OTC access, and two other OBGYNs wrote a piece in opposition. And so I'm going to base part of this on their arguments. And then there was also recently a letter to the editor that was published in The Lancet. And kind of if you look at the concerns that these physicians cite, they can kind of be lumped into these various categories. First has to do with concerns about the safety of over-the-counter provision, specifically that women wouldn't be able to identify conditions that make oral contraceptive use dangerous, or they wouldn't be able to self-screen for the contraindications. Another concern is that without the counseling that women would get by going to see a clinician, that they wouldn't use the pills as well as they could. And then the other kind of areas of concerns have to do with other stuff that women might miss out on if they're not forced to come into a clinic visit. One category of that other stuff has to do with other preventive screening. And then it's also a missed opportunity to counsel women about other potentially more appropriate contraceptive methods. And then finally, the area that gets talked about a little bit less is the economic concerns. So what about self-screening for contraindications? Kelly talked a little bit about that in her talk. But the physicians' concerns that are cited in these pieces have to do, first of all, that women might ignore the warnings that would be on an over-the-counter product, or they might not read them, or they might not understand them, and that they might not actually be able to self-diagnose the contraindications. So in terms of that first piece about that they wouldn't read the actual labeling or understand it. I mean, obviously before, one of the requirements, I think, for an OTC switch would be that the manufacturer would have to do a label comprehension study to prove that women actually, the potential users, understand the labeling. But there is some evidence that users of over-the-counter products do usually follow the instructions. There's a survey that is from Ireland that shows that about 86% of the public said that they always or often followed over-the-counter drug instructions. And then as far as the part about being able to self-diagnose contraindications, there are now about four published studies that are looking at this issue at self-screening. Two of them come from Mexico, where pills are de facto available over the counter. And in both of those studies, it seems that women who get their pills directly at a pharmacy without a prescription, without seeing a clinician, are no more likely to actually have a contraindication to use. And then there are two studies that have been done in the U.S., one in Washington State among people actually attending family planning clinics that found that women were able to accurately diagnose contraindications using a checklist according to the WHO medical eligibility criteria. And their self-assessment was very accurate and correlated well with clinicians' assessment. In fact, when there was discrepancy, it was actually more likely that women would say that they were contraindicated when in fact they weren't. We recently completed a study together with colleagues at University of Texas in El Paso. It was a study of about 1,300 women, a convenient sample of women of reproductive age, where we asked them to use a similar checklist using the WHO criteria and then compared their ability to self-diagnose contraindications to a nurse practitioner, and the nurse practitioner also measured their blood pressure. And in fact, the checklist was quite accurate. It had a sensitivity of about 83%, specificity of about 89%. About 6% of women thought they were eligible for oral contraceptives, but in fact they were found to be contraindicated by the nurse practitioner. And a similar percentage, about 7%, thought that they were not eligible for oral contraceptives when in fact they were. The ones who thought they were okay for pill use, but in fact weren't, that was largely due to unrecognized hypertension. I should say that this is a population that doesn't have access to screening and preventive care services. But in general, younger women, interestingly Spanish speakers, and women who were more educated in our study were more accurate at self-screening. Obviously, the younger women were just also much less likely to be contraindicated. And then also, as Kelly said, I think it's important whenever we're talking about self-screening for contraindications to know what we're comparing that to. And as she mentioned, clinician screening isn't perfect. That study that looked at data from the NHANES data set found that about 6% of women who are currently using pills in the United States, so they had to get a prescription, they had to have been seen by a clinician, about 6% of those women are actually contraindicated. But the issue of hypertension is certainly an important one, and the issue of unrecognized hypertension is important. I think it's also important to recognize that you don't have to go to a doctor's office necessarily to get your blood pressure measured, that their blood pressure screening is available in other settings, in pharmacies, in grocery stores, and that doesn't necessarily mean that we have to force people to go to a clinic. So what about this issue of counseling and quality of use? In the one of the opinion pieces, the physicians talked about how women might misinterpret common side effects that they would have on the pill and think that they're serious complications and perhaps go to the emergency room or stop using the pill. Women also might be less compliant with consistent use of the pills if they don't receive adequate counseling. And I think these things are true. There are definitely data showing that there's a relationship between a lack of contraceptive knowledge and poor compliance. But unfortunately, the bottom line is that we're not doing a very good job as clinicians actually educating users about appropriate use of oral contraceptives. I mean, there's several studies that have shown that even in settings like in the US or in the United Kingdom where there's a requirement to obtain pills by getting a prescription, even in those settings, knowledge about oral contraceptive use is low. One study in England found that about 12% of current users knew the rules for good oral contraceptive compliance. Another study found that over a third of women incorrectly answered questions about risk factors associated with potential failure of oral contraceptives. So there's a study from Kuwait where oral contraceptives are available over the counter in which they looked at women who get their pills from a physician versus those who get them directly from a pharmacy without a prescription and found that continuation was about the same. So there's no worse off. There doesn't appear to be worse continuation among women who get them over the counter. We, together again with colleagues at University of Texas, are currently performing a cohort study in the El Paso area in Texas, where some women cross the border to Mexico and get pills over the counter, and we're following women who get their pills in public clinics in Texas versus women who get their pills over the counter in Mexico, and looking at continuation over a period of about 9 months, and we hope to have those results by next year. But certainly we do need more data about this issue of counseling and quality of use in an OTC environment. So what about this issue about screening exams? Some of the arguments that have been made are that women in an OTC, if they could get their pills over the counter, that they might not come in for annual exams, for sexually transmitted infection screening, for pap smears. And as is mentioned in that contemporary OBGYN piece, there's a concern especially that OC use might increase the risk of cervical cancer. And so this is especially important for this population. I think it's important to point out even just the fact that talking about annual exams, I mean, the current evidence is that many women don't need to have a pap smear every year now. So we could even say that just the first point is a little bit moot. But there's definitely a consensus. There have been now multiple papers published looking at this issue that really screening breast and pelvic exams are not required to dispense hormonal contraception, that they are independent, important screening tests But there's really no reason why we need to hold women's contraception hostage and make them come in for these exams, you know, in order to get their contraception. There is also some evidence suggesting that women come in to get their, they recognize this, the pap smears are important, and they get these services anyway. From the Pharmacy Access Partnerships study, in a U.S. Representative study survey, they found that among current non-users of contraception, so women who don't have to come into a clinic, about 88% of them had said that they had had a pap smear in the past 2 years. So even though they weren't forced to come in, they were coming in to get their pap smears anyway. And actually, the labeling for oral contraceptives has been changed to say that it's not required that you need to do a pelvic exam before actually starting oral contraceptives. But how well are physicians actually following these guidelines? This is information from a survey of OBGYNs that was done in 2003, where they presented various vignettes. The study was looking at various issues, but I just pulled out the one vignette related to prescribing oral contraceptives. So this was a vignette of a woman seeking a refill of oral contraceptives whose last PAP had been about a year ago. So the vignette was a 24-year-old woman with no prior history of cervical dysplasia, who calls and she says she only has 3 pills left in her pack, and she is asking for a refill of pills. At her last office visit a year ago, her pap smear was normal, and she had no contraindications to hormonal contraception. And they found that only 3% of OBGYNs in the survey actually said that they would refill a full year of pills for this woman. Large majority, 92%, said that they would give her a few packs of pills until she came in to get her next pap. So they would wait to give her any more until she actually came in. Those who were practicing in an academic setting actually would refill for a whole year. And the only other sort of demographic or other practice-related factor that was associated with giving more pills was, physicians who did fewer PAPs, less than 30 PAPs per week, were less willing to refill pills. So I think this kind of shows that despite these recommendations, the PAP and pelvic still sort of remains a barrier to hormonal contraception in the U.S. What about this issue of the missed opportunity to offer other contraceptives? In this letter to the editor in The Lancet that I mentioned, they said that that over-the-counter provision or pharmacist provision restricts choice because women are not able to access long-acting methods like IUDs or implants directly in a pharmacy, that they would have to come into a clinic. And if they don't come in, they're not forced to come into the clinic, they won't get information about these methods. I think that in many ways this argument is sort of similar to the pelvic exam and breast exam argument, that we're sort of holding contraceptive hostage. I think it's important that we need to educate women and provide more information about other methods and make sure that women know about these methods, but again, we don't necessarily have to force them to come in. Some data from a study that we did looking at the Mexican National Health Survey found that women actually move a fair amount between both provision sources. So it's not just like if a woman is an OTC user that she always goes to the pharmacy and never goes to the clinic. We found in this study in Mexico that about 69% of women who were currently getting their pills in a pharmacy actually initiated use with a clinician. So even in an OTC environment, women are still accessing clinics and having contact with clinicians. So they could get this information there. In terms of the financial concerns, I think probably the biggest concern is the possibility of lost revenue due to fewer clinic visits. And this is a very real concern. And it'll be something interesting to discuss during our discussion, the time that we have for discussion, and what kind of impact that might actually have, you know, especially on family planning clinics that are serving low-income women that may be their only source of preventive care. Perhaps, I mean, there are other forces that are kind of limiting revenue from reselling oral contraceptives obtained through discount prescription drug pricing systems, so I don't think that that would have as much, the OTC switch wouldn't have as much impact there. We could talk more about that if that is of interest to people. But I just wanted to talk briefly about pharmacy provision. There's some discussion about whether, you know, as an interim step, perhaps before making the pill available over the counter, one possibility was that it could be available in a pharmacy sort of through a pharmacist. And I just wanted to look at, you know, how interested are pharmacists actually in being providers of hormonal contraception? And I'm going to present a little bit from a survey of National Survey of Pharmacists that was performed by the Pharmacy Access Partnership in 2004 and 2005, which is currently in press and I think will be coming out in the beginning of next year. And they looked at what pharmacists' attitudes were toward providing hormonal contraception in their pharmacies. And interestingly, pharmacists were quite interested. 85% of people in the survey said they were interested in providing direct pharmacy access to hormonal contraception, and about half said that they were very interested. And you can see some of their motivations behind the interest. They thought this was an important public health issue. They wanted to have more individual patient contact. They thought this was an opportunity for them in terms of their professional development, that it might strengthen the relationships with physicians and clinics and also increase business. In general, the vast majority felt very comfortable measuring blood pressure and weight and asking questions to try to assess for medical contraindications. A little concerning is that fewer than half felt very comfortable with questions about sexual activity, and they identified some of the training needs that would be required before starting to initiate hormonal contraception provision. Some of the barriers they mentioned were a lack of payment mechanisms, liability issues, constraints on time, as well as lack of private counseling spaces in the pharmacies, as well as the possible cost to start up the services and corporate policies. So in conclusion, I think that, you know, some of the concerns that physicians are expressing are certainly valid, and some might require additional data, additional research, but I think it's also important to point out that many of them are not based on existing evidence. We need more research to address some of the clinicians' valid concerns, and we need to also educate clinicians about some of the more recent research findings that could address some of their concerns. I think it's also important to disseminate, we need to think about ways to disseminate other evidence about how we can simplify access to contraception that could happen right now. Things like dispensing more pill packs, which has been demonstrated to improve continuation, quick start initiation, things that many clinicians haven't yet incorporated into their practice, as well as the evidence about current pap smear screening guidelines. I think one issue that would be interesting to sort of throw out to the group is, you know, do we really need to have clinician support to make over-the-counter access a reality? Do we need it? If so, how can we get more clinicians on board? And as an interim step, pharmacy access may improve access to hormonal contraception, and definitely the data from this survey suggests that a majority of pharmacists are interested in expanding their service into this area. Thank you.
I meant to say when I started, so sorry for leaving out this logistics, we're going to leave discussion until after Cindy's presentation next. If there are any burning questions of clarity or something you just can't wait until after one more presentation? None? Okay, great. Cindy Pearson is the Executive Director of the National Women's Health Network. She has been at the National Women's Health Network since 1987 and has had a number of roles there, including coordinating the internship program, managing their information clearinghouse, directing the program and policy work, and she became the Executive Director in 1996. She also has experience as an abortion rights organizer for NARAL, and has worked with women's health centers in a women's health center in the San Diego area. And you spent some time, you're a displaced Californian.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll turn it over to you.
Thanks. I was watching people come in after we got started, and some of you may not have heard Kelly's announcement at the very beginning about Destiny Lopez not being able to make it to this session. I'm not giving Destiny's talk, but I have changed my talk a little bit to touch on some areas that we'd agreed in advance that Destiny would cover, and I want to make sure they're addressed at least briefly. And I'm not using slides. I'm not using a PowerPoint. So at first I thought I'd ask Kelly to get the lights back on, and then I realized I'm going to begin this talk with a series of questions to y'all in the audience. I'm going to ask you to raise your hands, and maybe you'd rather have some measure of slight confidentiality since I'm doing unapproved research on you, but it's not really research. It's just part of my talk and my experience. So I'm going to ask six or seven questions here, and I just ask people to raise their hands. The first question: should women and men be able to choose how to express their sexuality based on their own values, those of their family, and those of their religion, if that's important to them? So how many would say yes? All right. Should women and men be able to freely choose whether or not to have children? How many would say yes? Should women and men be able to act on these values and these choices for themselves without the permission of a physician? How many would say yes? Should women and men have unimpeded access to the technology that enables them to act on these values and choices? How many would say yes? Should women and men have access to information that supports fully informed decision making about their health? How many would say yes? Should women and men have free access to healthcare services that support the highest attainable standard of health? How many would say yes? And should social policy be organized to support the health of the population by investing in social determinants of healthcare, such as housing, access to food, high quality education? How many would say yes? How many of us think that all of these issues play a part in whether or not it would be the right thing to do for women overall for oral contraceptives to be made over the counter? Probably a lot of us. I do. I, for one, do. How many of us think that the family planning movement or the reproductive rights movement has any capability to affect all these things? I consider myself part of that movement. I don't believe that the family planning movement or the reproductive rights movement has the capability to affect whether or not society supports, invests in social determinants of health, or whether or not we make access to high-quality health care freely available to all in our country. Those are important goals and important movements, and here at a public health conference, we're more likely to be in a room where all of those issues are talked about at once. But I ran through that series of questions because I wanted to open my talk by making it clear that to many of us, including the people who talk about an OTC switch in very specific ways about the safety of oral contraceptives or about the attitudes of those who would be giving up their control, their prescribing power, many of us look at the question of oral contraceptives being available over the counter with this broader perspective of, does it support the highest attainable standard of health? Does it contribute to people being able to have access to services, healthcare services that keep them as close as possible to that highest attainable standard of health? It's a lot to put on the shoulders of a little package of pills. And yet, this is the real world. So I just want to raise up a few of the questions that come from what is now being called the reproductive justice movement, which in shorthand is feminism crossed with social justice. An example of the reproductive justice for those who are new to you is an emphasis on the civil rights of pregnant women, that pregnant women don't need to just be concerned about their reproductive rights, but they need to be concerned and need to be treated as if they have rights as people to make fully informed decisions and to medical care, whether or not they are following everyone's ideal standards of behavior, say, for example, struggling with substance abuse. That's part of the reproductive justice movement, the fighting against family caps and welfare policies. That's part of the reproductive justice movement. So looking at the question of whether or not women's health would be improved by making oral contraceptives available over the counter, we all agreed going down those first questions, yes, 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 right? We believe women should be able to make this choice for themselves about how to act on their sexuality. We believe women should be able to make the choice for themselves of whether or not to have children and when. We believe women and men should have access to that technology without it being held captive by a professional. And we believe that women and men should have access to a full range of health services. And that's where I think our concerns about how best to go forward start to our nicely woven carpet of people who care about women's reproductive health from many different perspectives the threads start to loosen a little bit when we start to talk about would women whose health is somewhat reasonably well supported now through federal or state or local funding for family planning services that provides health services in addition to the prescription contraception, would that start to jeopardize women's access to care? Now, Dan and Kelly did a really nice job of pointing out how able women are, how safe low-dose oral contraceptives are, relatively speaking, how few women are truly contraindicated from using them, how capable women are at self-selecting, self-identifying most of the major contraindications for oral contraceptive use, and how probably women are on a par with clinicians in how good they would be at self-selecting themselves for contraindications versus busy clinicians in the average run-of-the-mill clinic where life isn't perfect. So if we all agree that far, then this agreement starts to just get a little less solid when it comes to what would be the effect of putting oral contraceptives available in the drugstore and leaving those good and health-promoting services like a regular exam, and I'm not going to say annual because, we know that that's a little bit of a myth, the necessity for an annual exam for all women of a certain age. And how can we look to anything to know whether or not we could do that safely? Well, we can look to emergency contraception over the counter for women over 18 and see that as a success story. As far as we can tell now, the fact that women can get access to episodic hormonal contraception in the drugstore hasn't interfered with their ability to access subsidized family planning, subsidized services that are provided in family planning settings. Now, the episodic nature of that hormonal contraception is probably pretty important to take into account when we look at the success of that example, of it not leading to less access to other health services. It is, though, also a little bit of an example for us of a cautionary tale of the cost. The cost is shocking. The cost is scandalous. The cost is ridiculous. It's kind of like the cost of regular contraception in college health centers right now. Scandalous, shocking, ridiculous, unfair, rotten. So we realize that as we look to easier access for making the rights of all women and men to have technology that's not access to technology that supports their values and choices about their health not held hostage unfairly or inappropriately, And in addition, we look to the data that Kelly put up about how much harder it is for low-income women, women with less education, to act on and access services that, that may well be there, but because of the difficulty in managing life with less education and less income, it's harder to get to those services. And so would this drugstore access, which is where you can get everything, right? Drugstores in every, there may not be a grocery store in every neighborhood, but there's a drugstore in every neighborhood. I work in D.C. It took until year earlier this year to get a new grocery store in one of the eight wards, the first new grocery store in one of the eight wards in something like 20 years, but there's drugstores all over that ward. So we hope that drugstore access would make access easier, and yet we see these problems with cost cropping up, you know, even with the episodic methods. We also see with the EC example that even though there should be Medicaid coverage automatically of EC over the counter, in fact, there's not. It's a slow process that has required a lot of advocacy input to get Medicaid coverage for EC over the counter. And so that the drugstore is easier sometimes than the clinic for all of us who are busy, and for low-income women or women with less education who might be more likely to be on Medicaid, at least in the states where Medicaid access is pretty decent, might be facing lack of coverage rather than easier access to something that's covered. And I guess the only other points that I want to bring up, in addition to the prescription being sort of the ticket to care now in our cobbled together system that isn't what we want, the cost of over-the-counter out-of-the-pocket sometimes being higher than a method while it's prescription, is I guess I want to, I feel it's important to bring up something that is frustrating to our colleagues in the family planning community, and it's a testament to their willingness to work this issue through with the broader community that they eagerly encourage us to be part of the working group and continue in dialogue with them. But the focus on making contraception easy as our first step forward, you know, that has some historical resonance in this country that doesn't remind us of good times in our country's life when contraception was the only service that low-income women or women of color could get. It doesn't take away the fact that those very women wanted it, were often part of advocating for it coming to their community and helping to set up the clinics in which it was provided, but it does call on a history of control by way of where resources are put. And so I can't end my talk with any easy conclusion, or not any clear-cut conclusion like Kelly and Dan have ended up with. Here's what we know about safety. There's the conclusion. Here's what we know about providers' attitudes. There's the conclusion. I feel like my role is just to raise questions that need to be addressed in concert by the communities of people who care about the sexual and reproductive health and freedom of everyone in our society. And we can't treat this, even as a narrow issue, it's an incredibly difficult issue because our society doesn't fully all raise its hands when we go through those questions about what women and men should be able to do. But even the narrow boundaries around what's a difficult question, I think, have to continue to be stretched out if we're ever able to go forward in a way that means that that list of seven questions gets more yes answers, more progress towards them being answered in the affirmative for a larger proportion of women living in this country. So thank you for giving me a chance to present this perspective in this group, and I really look forward to the discussion.
Thank you very much. So we now have half an hour for a discussion, which is great. And we're looking forward to hearing from all of you. And great, I see Cynthia Harper has the first question. But just to say, I'm sorry we don't have microphones to hand around. So if you can shout as loud as you can and say who you are, that would be great.
Just say one other thing about the cost. I think also one difference with comparing the EC situation to oral contraceptives is that at the time with Plan B, I mean, there was only one product. And so then and it went over time. But you're right, women can still get it by prescription. But the difference with oral contraceptives is that at least initially it would be one or maybe two products that would go OTC and the rest would still be on prescription. So women would be able to access, I mean, if they had prescription coverage, they would be able to access the prescription-only pills once they go by prescription.
So there was one in the back here, and two, three, four. Right.
Because it's different if she hands over a $5 or $10 copay versus $50 for an over-the-counter one-month supply. She happens to be on a branded type. I know that she's subsidized by her private health insurance.
Right.
She's one of, you know, most of the women in California who need to have that, whether you're Medicaid or privately funded. I think nationwide, that prescription is the key to coverage.
Right.
So my comment really is like
Right.
Right.
And I think, and I'll start on this one, maybe then I'll turn over to both of you guys. Those are critical issues. I think it is important to remember that many women who have private insurance, who pay copays, are paying $25. And so, again, we get into some of these questions of who is paying what now, which is widely divergent, depending on who you are, what state you live in, whether there's a mandate, whether you have, you know, in Massachusetts, health reform, you have a subsidized plan, whether you don't have a subsidized plan, whether it's employer-based, whether it's at your school. I mean, we have a crazy system, as Cindy mentioned, that means it ranges a lot for different people. So what moving over the counter could for some people make it better, and it might be that for some people, like someone with a $5 copay, that it would make it worse. And so I think there are two issues. One is, as Cindy mentioned about EC over the counter, we do have a movement to get Medicaid, and there are state models of having Medicaid pay for over the counter things. Like in New York, you can get condoms paid for by Medicaid. Sure. Sure. Well, but that doesn't have to be the model. I mean, I'm talking about Medicaid and OTC because you mentioned it only will cover prescriptions. So, you know, I think we have to think a little bit creatively. Like with the OC's example, people are walking in New York and getting it with their Medicaid card now that it's over the counter. That does not require a prescription to get paid for. So, again, I think pushing those limits of what we deal with Medicaid. But let me stop and see if you guys want to.
There are a lot of unknowns about the cost issue. Kelly mentioned that someone would pay $25, but we actually, the only published study, Catherine Phillips did at UCSF, looking at what actually women are paying in terms of copays, is from data that's 10 years old, and that was $14 per pack. So we don't really know currently what women are even paying for copays. So there are a lot of unknowns. I mean, there's a couple of studies that have looked at what happens with an OTC switch, and generally out-of-pocket costs do rise. And that's a concern. I think that the issue with pills is that there would still be some pill formulations that would be prescription only and be accessible with a prescription. And those people would have to, yeah, for Medicaid coverage, you might have to go to a clinician. But there are definitely a lot of unknowns.
So the person sitting behind Cynthia in the brown, you had your hand up. Right. Okay, so I think I had one over here, then the green, then the pink, Dr. Darney, and the blue, and then Tracy. So, yes. Sorry, I wish I knew everyone's name.
Problems in this country with pharmacists that don't want to deal with it, with age issues,
Do you want to start on that one, Cindy?
It's a great articulation of the concerns of a caring clinician or a caring person in the field of, you know, family planning and reproductive health, that women are real people. They're not just ovaries. They're, you know, they're not just uteruses. That in, there's a lot else going on for women who are sexually active. In my fantasy world, there would be a way for women to get good counseling, which I know there's a lot of crummy counseling or non-existent counseling, in the interaction that led to them using whatever technology they wanted to use to have sex safely. You know, community health workers, pharmacists, you know, there's a lot of different ways you could do that. My fantasy world isn't coming to fruition very quickly here. So I can't say that's the model that I want to put out, and if we could make that model exist, then it would all be okay, because I don't think we're going to get there. And how do we continue to justify a different standard for women and men having access to the technology that helps them act on the choices that they've made that are based on the values that are important to them and their family about whether or not to be sexually active and whether or not to have children and when? Why is anything we said different for a young man than a young woman?
What if
Right. So Dan wants to make one comment,
yeah,
and then...
Yeah, those are all great points. I think one thing that's important to also highlight from our research that we're doing in Mexico, as I said, where pills are available over-the-counter, is that when over-the-counter provision is an option, it doesn't mean that you're cutting off the option of going to a clinic. As I mentioned, 70% of women in the Mexican National Health Survey who are currently getting pills directly from a pharmacy started taking a pill under the supervision of a clinician. So they valued that counseling, and they got it. And we're also finding in our research in Texas, women who are going across the border to get pills over the counter, over 90% have had a pap smear within the last 3 to 5 years. So women know that these other services are important, and they get them anyway. We don't have to make them come in, because they'll come in anyway.
The woman in the green. Go ahead.
And your point is well taken about the fact that there are multiple kinds of drugs, and the drug interactions with other medications that these women are taking, they can screen themselves for the ability to, you know, whether or not they have contraindications for this drug, but how is that going to interact with whatever else they're taking? I'm not sure that we can be sure that they have the ability to screen themselves that way. My other question is, you mentioned Mexico and Kuwait as countries where this is already in existence, and with the emergency contraceptive, you know, a lot of countries in Europe have been doing this for a while, and it was, you know, well vetted, you might say. What other countries are currently using this over-the-counter oral contraceptive method, and how is it working there, other than Mexico and Kuwait?
I mean, first, in terms of the drug interactions, I mean, the reality is that there are very few medications that are actually, that affect efficacy of oral contraceptives. In our study, where we looked at the ability to self-screen, we actually also looked at whether women could read the list of those drugs and check the box whether they were taking them, and they did that one very well. In terms of other countries, there are actually very few countries where it's actually legal for pills to be available over the counter, but in many countries, in Africa and Latin America, pills are available de facto over the counter. There aren't much data that we have about that. As far as I'm aware, the data that I talked about from Mexico is really the best documented case.
I think there's nice data on community health workers.
Yes, there's very good data.
We're not going to get that data,
yeah.
Very old.
Yeah.
Okay, so one here, and then Dr. Durney after that.
I'm from New Orleans, and I'm really
thank you for that. Dr. Darney, and then. Right. Right. But of course, the challenge is that the women who don't get their pills and got pregnant and had a higher risk of stroke don't get in those studies, right? So we're missing the population of people who can't access, don't get to a provider, but who might be able to or willing to access over the counter. So I think that's one comment. I don't know if you, either of you wanted to add. In Kuwait, yeah. Thanks.
I would say from the history of the women's health movement, we believe we saw extremely strong proof that women can self-screen for what can be described on a label. Estrogen products were the first prescription products widely used that had a requirement for patient package insert. It went into place in the late 70s when high-dose pills were still pretty commonly used in the United States, although they, a lot of you know, gone out of favor in other countries. And when this information got into women's hands, the rates of clots and stroke in the United States dropped before the dosage, the average dose that women got dropped. And so we've always taken that. That wouldn't have anybody's peer review that I just described. It's hardly barely a time trend study, but we've always taken it as proof that if women get good information, they can act on it in wise and safe ways. And so that women self-selected them, you know, they looked at what are the complications, what are the warning signs, they didn't start pills, did they stop at an early warning sign and avoided the big problem. So we're not so even though we might share a kind of a feminist reproductive justice concern, we might share the concerns of some people who say, aren't women going to miss the information that they need by being sexually active? And we do have that concern that women, it's great if women and men have a chance for interaction. We don't share the concern that women can't walk in, I'm sorry that you are still here, we don't share the concern that women can't walk into a drugstore, pick up a package, read the instructions, and figure out things like that. But the one thing that kind of holds my organization up is the high blood pressure.
Right.
And, you know, Kelly's looking for innovative ways to women get screened for high blood pressure, but, you know, Phil, your idea of women getting a license for X number of years worth of pills based on their good blood pressure, that license thing kind of goes against my shouldn't women have the same freedom that men do to have access to safe and effective technology that supports the decision they make for themselves. You know, if you've got to show your license, that's maybe at least in a different word, though.
So I'm behind on my questioners here. I know Tracy had one in the back, but did you have a point directly to this? You were enthusiastically raising your hand. Were all these people related to each other?
To even make it less managed.
Were all these three people related to each other?
No.
No. I mean, unfortunately, one of the problems is that the only screening for clots, particularly among people under 35, we don't even do when people go to get OCs now, because it's not, because the rate of the genetic mutation that really is the big predictor of clots in younger people is, you know, you'd have to screen so many people to detect one. But Dan, I don't know if you, as the clinician on the panel, want to add to my...
No, I mean, it's what you said. I mean, also, again, like you said, the comparison of being pregnant with an unwanted pregnancy because you couldn't access contraception also puts you at risk for having...
I'm sorry, I have to go back to Tracy because she was before and I have not gone back.
But I don't want
to
minimize...
Right.
Well, my favorite example of people judging whether or not women can make good decisions about who they affect with and how often was an example I heard at one of the EC meetings where people were sharing the struggle of getting it covered by Medicaid, and in some states there were limits. You could only get a certain number of EC prescriptions filled on your Medicaid or covered by your Medicaid. And maybe it was 2 a year, or maybe it was 3 a year. And I had an example in my back pocket from a middle-aged man with private health insurance who could get 17 Viagra a month. Excuse me, I think people are making some real crummy judgments about who women can have sex with and how often.
One, two, three, and then back to Dr. Darney. Yeah.
It wasn't the women's liberation. And then second thing is, I'm sure your reaction to this license business, but what if when you can get better blood pressure screening, make it available, if people just got a little card
right.
certified where they were screened and what it was and when, and then they can show that at the pharmacy, not the blood type.
I don't think we know. Do you know the Kuwait story? I don't know the Kuwait story. I'm sure. We'll have to find it out.
Yeah, I mean, the card issue is insane. We've sort of started exploring, talking to like people about the possibility of having like a vending machine, even, where like, you had to go to see a clinician and get your little card with the magnetic stripe or whatever, or your ATM card that you could put into this machine and get refills, essentially, for other passage calls. And something we're looking into, apparently, it would be incredibly expensive to actually design a machine.
Yeah. Right, or a pharmacist could write it down after they'd done it. Yeah.
I mean, Susan,
oh, go ahead.
I mean, we don't have much time.
We don't have much time.
Pharmacy access to and whether getting a prescription, that would remove many of these barriers by making hormonal contraception directly available in pharmacy. If that would be a good thing, or if that might just be sort of replacing one gatekeeper with another.
And as the previous person mentioned about refusals, is something to keep in mind. Susan, and then. There was someone on that side. Is about who's talked to you last, right?
Yeah.
So, Dan, do you want to?
I mean, yeah, I think that's true, that there really are very few differences, I mean, actually demonstrated differences among various pill products. And so, yeah, what clinicians have a favorite pill or the one that they have in the closet as a, you know, they just got from drug company, and then there, it's not a very evidence-based decision about which pill is right for a woman. And then it's a lot of trial and error. That if a woman has side effects or problems with one pill, maybe you would change the estrogen dose, maybe you would try a different progestin. But, you know, I don't think that that's a huge barrier. Again, going back to the Mexico data showing that 70% of women who are currently pharmacy users started with a clinician. So women who had difficulty making that choice about whatever OTC products are available could still go, ideally, in an ideal world, would still have that opportunity to go to a clinician and get additional help trying to figure that out. As well as she, if she had problems with the product that she chose and she needed to change.
But I think it's also perhaps equally as important as a perception issue. I think it is overwhelming, and it will be, should there be a switch, for to get out clear information about what to do. Because if you walk in there and there are 50, you know, I mean, I can't decide what kind of lemon-scented cleaner to use. You know, when you're standing in front of 100 choices and you don't know how to pick, and, you know, we would... Right. And ideally, we would come up with strategies like we've had for EC, where when we're asking women to make their own with their pills, where you can go to a website and look at what some of the different options are and how you might, you know, to provide as many aids as we can. There is a woman over here, yep, who I haven't come back to.
What is the process for making this happen? Does the pharmaceutical company have to bring this forward, or
sponsor has to ask? We're laughing because I'm politically influenced. So part of my job in the 20 years I've been in the Women's Health Network is to be our representative to FDA advisory committee meetings when they're talking about reproductive health issues. And things can get acted on in 3 months, or they can go into the other line for years.
But just with a, say, a change in administration, what's sort of the best scenario? If there were a company that had a product that they wanted to show?
You know, I can't answer that, Dan, because I don't think the best scenario is instantly rushing forward just because we have a pro-choice president and we can get it done. But, you know, the FDA has got those there are rules now in the FDA that unless they break their own rules like they did for EC over the counter for such a long time, or they officially sort of stop the clock, they have to make a decision within either 3 months or 6 months. I may not have those numbers exactly right, but it's within months.
Yep. Sorry, I don't know your name. So you mean the proposed rule by DHHS to, does anyone, I mean, I know that they received over 200,000 comments. I know it's in kind of the purgatory of reviewing those comments and deciding what's going to happen. Does anyone have more information than me? I think that the impact would be horrible, as on many things, potentially, but how it would play out in detail, we don't know. We are over, so I certainly understand if people have to go, but I'm happy to stay and take a couple more questions if people are happy to stay. Dr. Darney, and then we have two people over here. It's wonderful. How many? Okay, we've got another person in the back, right? Do you want to explain for the non-clinicians what your PRN lingo means?
You're saying this person can go back and get birth control pills whenever she wants to. Anytime she wants them, she can go get them. I don't care if she comes back to the office. She can just have them as long as she wants to get them.
Yes, unfortunately, you're in the minority at the academic centers where people are really, you know, giving many, giving longer prescriptions, giving more packs, giving more freedom.
3% did write
3%. 3% in that, and yet I said, you know, they were willing to give another year's prescription without seeing anything back.
Yeah. So in the white and brown, yep, and then yellow is next. Thanks. Sorry, I had one over here before. Go ahead. Yeah. Right. In theory, I mean, there is one, in the short term, the first person who went over the counter would get some exclusivity in the market.
Right.
So for the immediate term, you might, no, Susan?
No, they're totally different products.
Yeah.
Well, okay, presuming that they... The same form. They couldn't get another of the same formulation, but in theory, they could get another combined formulation. Okay.
So if you have the brand and then the generic could come over the counter after the brand, and then those generally cost, they would be competing at cost of
right.
The other one than that brand and their generic, so you still
yeah, that's what
high cost, but it'd be competing.
And I think the question on the cost thing that we don't know the answer to is that the company that moves it over the counter will choose their price, right? What they think the market can bear. And I think historically from other products that go over the counter, it's often a higher price than it is under prescription. So we don't know in detail.
It's not the price we like. It hasn't.
Well, yeah, the example that you gave.
So it's probably better with oral contraceptives than many of the other things that you could potentially use inappropriately over the counter, but because they're safer. But
I guess one thing I'd like to put out there is the idea that there's one type of pill that is best for a particular woman, and that is an important part of a decision and for a decision-making process is more a matter of marketing plans than science to back it up. For the most part, any woman who had decided for herself she wanted to be sexually active, decided for herself that she wanted to use oral contraceptives, could read the checklist of, do you have this, do you have that, what about this, what about that, she could then pick anything that was there.
But what if we don't know what hypertension is? If you ask someone to spell hypertension, they spell it H-I-G-H space P-E-R. I mean,
right, that's the one for me. That's where I can't.
Well, and you wouldn't say hypertension on a self-screening sheet. I mean, you say high blood pressure, you know, which is better understood. So I think there certainly are tools that you can do to make the information easier to understand. I mean, I don't know if you want to say what you said in your screening checklist that worked well.
I mean, just that to date, so far in the studies that looked at how well women can understand this information and self-screen, it's pretty good that they can do a good job. But I think, again, I just want to say again, in an OTC environment, it wouldn't eliminate the option of going to a clinic or seeing a clinician or talking to a pharmacist. And so women who had questions or wanted more information could do that. But I also think we need to do a much better job about making that information available in the community. There's a lot of data, my work is with Latinos, and there's a lot of evidence that they get information about contraception from friends and family members and not from a clinic, and so we need to do a better job of getting this information out into the community about what are appropriate contraceptive options. So I agree, I think we need to do a better job getting that information out there. The reality is, in the current clinic requirement environment, we're not doing a good job.
And the last question. Yep, you get the last question.
Cycles of
I hope you'll share that data with all the insurance companies in the United States that force women to get one pack of pills at a time. No, I think it's a great point. Again, I think it's important as our comparison group to say, what would they do if they couldn't get oral contraceptives? So, yes, we want to encourage people not to extend their pill-free intervals, but if their choice is to come back a little bit late in an OTC environment or they don't have access and they might get pregnant, you know, that's also, I think, an important thing to keep in the back of our minds. But does anyone else want to talk about? No? Great. Well, thank you so much for all the great questions, for the great discussion. And does anyone have that sign-up sheet for the working group? Oh, great, Dr. Darney. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I have to go to Columbia. And there's no garbage can. Hi. How are you? Just trying to get up here because there's no garbage can.
Just to keep everybody's eyes focused forward. Do you want to check in? You are. Let's do that.